This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, so my name's Morgan Berry. I'm a PhD candidate at Northwestern. And I'm here to introduce our session and our speakers. So first up is Premilla Nadasen. She is the Anne Whitney Olin Professor of History at Barnard College and co-director of the Barnard Center for Research on Women. She's the author of several books on women and labor organizing and care work, most recently Care, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. She joins us here today to discuss her forthcoming biography of Miriam Makeba. Second is Martha Biondi. She's the Lorraine Morton Professor of Black Studies and Professor of History at Northwestern. She's also my advisor. She is the author of two award-winning books, To Stand and Fight and The Black Revolution on Campus. And she is here today to discuss her forthcoming biography of Prexy Nesbitt and the Solidarity Within Southern Africa Movement. Third is Lynette Jackson. She is an associate professor of Black Studies and Gender and Women's Study at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She is also a human rights activist and the author of several books and articles, including Surfacing Up, Psychiatry and Social Order in Colonial Zimbabwe. She is also the author of a forthcoming biography on Winnie Mandela. All here today to discuss their upcoming biographies and the movement against apartheid and for self-determination in South Africa. First, Premilla.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Socialism 2024. I'm really happy to be here with my co-panelists. And I am, as Morgan said, I'm writing a biography of Miriam Makeba. But I've shifted my talk a little bit, obviously, in terms of thinking about this global context that we're living in, where genocide is unfolding before our very eyes. And obviously, there's a lot of importance in terms of what the anti-apartheid movement can teach us about what's happening in Palestine. So I'm going to shift my comments a little bit based on that. So the anti-apartheid movement has particular relevance for us today, in part because of the systems of segregation, control of movement of people, denial of citizenship and rights, and the brutal violence that undergirded both the South African apartheid regime and the Israeli apartheid regime. But also because these movements have been deeply intertwined, the anti-resistance or the resistance movements have been deeply intertwined and deploying similar strategies. The anti-apartheid movement was one of the largest and most influential anti-colonial movements in history, spanning at least 60 years from the 1930s to the 1990s. In the US, it was a black-led multiracial movement that understood apartheid as part of a larger constellation of colonial powers. It was a movement that believed that South Africa was not an aberration to the promises of liberal democracy, as some people argued, but instead was a manifestation of global imperialism. Apartheid was a system of racial difference and hierarchy organized for the purposes of capitalist exploitation. I have both a personal and political interest in this subject. I'm from South Africa. I was born under apartheid. And the bio that Morgan read, thank you very much, it often erases the real importance of our work, which is the organizing that we do. I first became involved in the anti-apartheid movement in high school when I lived in Michigan, and then went on and organized at the University of Michigan in the 1980s. So I'm interested in how transnational anti-imperial movements come into being. I understand my own connection to this topic, but how and why do people come to care about a place that they've never been to? What moves us to develop solidarity? And so this is what brought me to my biography of Mary Makeba. For those of you who don't know, Makeba was a South African musician, performer, and activist who was celebrated across the world. She was exiled from South Africa in 1959 and spent most of her career outside the country of her birth, not returning to South Africa until 1990. She traveled the world spreading messages of black pride and resistance. She was dubbed Mama Africa and came to represent the African continent, for better or for worse, and facilitated the development of the international anti-apartheid and black power movements. For black activists, she came to symbolize the pain and suffering of European colonialism. So her story speaks to themes of transnational circulations and the power of music and culture as a foundation of political solidarity. And I'm also interested in gendering the transnational black power movement. Makeba was at nearly every key moment of the Pan-African and international black power movements. She spoke before the United Nations about the devastating consequences of apartheid. She was there at the formation of the Organization of African Unity. She performed at the Pan-African Festival in Algiers in 1969. She was there at the opening celebration and performed at the independence of Kenya. Yet, she's rarely mentioned in narratives of post-war black power and Pan-Africanism. Yet, so I think Makeba is kind of, in some ways, an ideal figure to analyze the politics of a black feminist agenda and transnational solidarity. She spoke four languages, and she sang in multiple more languages, including Hebrew. One of the songs she sang very early on was a song called Seven Good Years, which she sang at her very first opening at the Village Vanguard in New York City in 1959. And she learned it, as she explained in her biography, from Sarah Sylvia, a South African Jewish actress, when she was in South Africa. When Makeba first arrived in the US, Harry Belafonte, who you all, I'm sure, know, served as her mentor. They toured together in the US, and they also went to Israel to perform. In part because of her associations with Belafonte, Makeba, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, was represented as an uncontroversial figure in the civil rights movement. She was involved in civil rights integrationist organizations such as the NAACP and the SCLC. It was a relatively safe icon for the anti-apartheid movement that I think could latch onto her as a symbolic figure. Makeba, however, began to question the political implications of touring in Israel and singing in Hebrew. And it created tension in her relationship with Belafonte, who was a stalwart supporter of the State of Israel. In May of 1963, Makeba and Belafonte canceled their scheduled Tel Aviv Israeli Independence Day concert, although Makeba did finally perform in Tel Aviv the following year. According to Makeba, some African delegates at the UN had asked her to drop the Israeli songs, which she actually was unsure if she should do or not. But when she informed Belafonte about the conversation, he became extremely angry, blasted her in the media, and removed her from the tour immediately. Belafonte's interview in the Los Angeles Times blames her for not wanting to perform the song. She viewed it as slander. So that was in the early and mid-1960s. By 1967, in June of 1967, there was obviously a turning point with the Six-Day War in Israel and Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, which led to the occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, the Sinai Peninsula, Golan Heights, and East Jerusalem. In the eyes of Makeba's African contemporaries, this repositioned Israel from a victim state to an aggressor state, and it curtailed any possibility for Palestinian freedom. The 67 war radicalized Arab students as well as Black Power activists. This is when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, along with many African member states of the UN, had proclaimed their solidarity with Palestine and against Zionism as a form of imperialism and racial segregation. So Makeba and Belafonte, who'd been working together for years, experienced an irreconcilable break. Her symbolic status had become, tentatively, according to one historian, a less palatable commodity across racial boundaries and across a political spectrum in the United States. Makeba's shows were canceled. She was blackballed from the industry in an organized campaign and a cultural war waged by opponents of the Palestinian struggle. And because of ongoing surveillance and harassment, in 1969, she and her husband, Kwame Ture, left for Guinea at the invitation of President Sekou Touré and lived there for the next 13 years. So there's been some scholarship on this pivot and Makeba's shift from affiliation with the mainstream civil rights movement to a Black Power anti-imperial position. Some scholars attribute this radicalization to her marriage to Kwame Ture, who was a member of SNCC and the co-author of SNCC's 1967 statement criticizing Israel. But they only met in 1968 and they married in 1969. So I think we have to have a broader framing for how and why Makeba had evolved. And I think more convincing explanations are about her political position and her understanding about Palestine as part of a broader anti-colonial struggle that was connected to South Africa as well as other independence movements around the world. She had extensive engagements with the Pan-African community, with students and Africans at the United Nations. She regularly invited South African students, as well as other African students, to her home in New York, preparing meals for them. And she traveled all over the world. So these global engagements, I think, had a powerful impact on her thinking about Palestine. So what are the lessons for Palestinian solidarity today? For Makeba, the question of Palestine solidarity, as I just said, was inextricable from this larger anti-imperial context. And it was really her connection with this larger movement that pushed her to tie the future of Palestine to the future of South Africa. Unlike for Belafonte, I think the national context was always primary. For us today, I think it means trying to reframe what is happening at Palestine, or as many of us already do, right, as part of a broader pattern of global racism that connects what's happening in Palestine to what's happening in Haiti, in the Congo, and in the Sudan. There are, of course, important differences between Palestine and South Africa. I went to Palestine for the first time in 2011 on a Women of Color delegation. Some of what I witnessed there was very reminiscent of South Africa, the security checkpoints, the separate roads, the spatial segregation, the border controls, the land theft, the labor exploitation. But whereas white South Africa relied on Black labor, that did not seem to be the case in Palestine quite as much. Palestinian life seemed expendable, especially with the increasing immigration of workers from elsewhere. And the outcome and the consequences of that is what we see today with the horrific, never-ending genocide. There is, in fact, a shocking disregard for Palestinian life. Finally, one thing that brought me to this topic is the vastly different ways that the anti-apartheid and Palestinian solidarity movements have been received. There's a the shocking disregard for Palestinian life is not only among Israelis who are perpetrating the genocide, but the political establishment here in the U.S. and in many other parts of the world as well. During the anti-apartheid movement, there were obviously differences and divergences and factions and disagreements. There was the Reaganites, of course, who advocated constructive engagement. You work with South African companies, you work with the government in order to transform apartheid. But there were very few people who would actually stand up and defend the apartheid state. But what we're seeing today is a powerful and inspiring global solidarity movement, but also unprecedented resistance and unrestrained attempts to crush even the slightest critical reference to what is happening in Palestine. So I'm going to pause there. I don't know if I'm doing okay on time, but yeah. So thank you. I look forward to a lively discussion.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to our panel, and I hope you all have a great conference. So thank you, Morgan, for the introduction. Again, my name is Martha Biondi, and my talk today is from a forthcoming book that's tentatively called The Struggle Continues, Prexy Nesbitt and U.S. Solidarity with Southern Africa. This morning, I will explore several key attributes of Prexy's internationalism that speaks to dilemmas and debates around solidarity organizing with Palestine today. And this project is really a political biography of Prexy and his circle, so I just want to remind everyone that when I'm sort of using his name, it's a proxy for a larger cohort. Black Chicago and Prexy Nesbitt's activist life began in a study abroad program in Tanzania in 1965, where he met freedom fighters in exile from the African National Congress and Front for the Liberation of Mozambique, or Frelimo, among others. This incredible year planted a seed that led to his playing a very prominent role in organizing U.S. solidarity for the major national liberation struggles in Mozambique, Namibia, Angola, and South Africa from the 1970s to the 1990s and beyond. I'm just curious, how many in this room know Prexy? Okay, thank you. Okay, in contrast to the black nationalist inflected Pan-Africanism that was popular among many African Americans in the late 1960s and 1970s, Prexy chose to identify instead as an internationalist. Internationalists built a socialist-leaning project of anti-imperialism that emphasized solidarity across lines of race, religion, and nationality. Like anti-colonialism more generally, internationalism encompassed opposites. It insisted on the right of national self-determination, yet also understood the limits of nation-states, especially those formed by European colonizers. Internationalism was, above all, a route away from colonial capitalism toward a post-colonial vision of economic redistribution and social justice. The 1970s saw a surge of interest in socialist experimentation across the global South, including in Africa. Radical imaginings of new forms of local empowerment, cooperatives, and development oriented towards social needs became popular after witnessing the first wave of formerly independent nation states grapple with continuing subordination to the dictates of foreign actors. Prexy and his comrades aimed to change U.S. foreign policy, U.S. corporate policy, and provide material assistance. Crucially, they understood the necessity of educating Americans about a faraway region where U.S. tax dollars were funding violent settler colonial regimes and counterinsurgencies. Consciousness raising was essential to making change. I will lift up six key attributes of Prexy's internationalism that speak to questions shaping solidarity organizing with Palestine today. I'll focus on the anti-apartheid struggle, but these points held for the broader Southern African liberation struggle. The first task of internationalists was to define the enemy. For Prexy, the definition used by Frelimo was foundational to his political outlook. The enemy was not the Portuguese, but colonialism. U.S. government aid to Portugal, but not the American people. Ditto for the ANC. the enemy was apartheid, white supremacy, anti-communism, U.S. state complicity, not white people per se. The struggle needed to be grounded in a structural analysis of political economy. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, good. A structural analysis of political economy, global forces, arms sales, etc., not identity. Frelimo embraced what they called a non-racial vision in their armed struggle against white settler regimes and Portuguese colonialism. As Samora Machel put it, quote, "We always say we are fighting a system and not the individuals within it." The goal, he argued, was not to establish black power in place of white power, but to destroy the colonialist state. A second lesson from Prexy's his circle was to build a big tent of support based on clear principles. For example, union and church support were crucial in the fight for sanctions and divestment. While running the program against racism at the World Council of Churches in Geneva, Prexy came to more deeply appreciate the Christian left. In 1983, he made a clandestine trip into South Africa to update South Africans on developments in the regional liberation struggles. The hosts were black and white nuns, the latter mostly Irish. They worried about surveillance, so according to Prexy, they, quote, "had intense political discussions in the pitch black walking around this nunnery." Prexy vividly recalls the anxiety that gripped the place, and suddenly it was decided that he and a Kenyan man needed to be immediately smuggled out. An Irish priest drove the two men, disguised as nuns, into Lesotho. There are countless examples, though. Another is that the women's division of the Methodist Church owned a center near the United Nations that became indispensable to building local, national, and transnational links in the anti-apartheid movement. Likewise, for the critical role of organized labor. Prexy had strong family and personal ties to unions in Chicago, and this helped immensely as he launched COBALSA, or the campaign against bank loans to South Africa in the late 1970s. The left-wing unions were the first to pull their funds from banks doing business in South Africa, but then others followed. Prexy tells the story of famed union leader Cleveland Robinson, an organizer of the March on Washington, who was shocked to learn that his union's pension funds were entangled in South Africa. "You're telling me that our union monies are helping to finance that killing of those children right now in South Africa? He asked. Prexy vividly recalls Robinson immediately picking up the phone and hearing him say, "You know that account we've got at Chase? Take the money out of it right now. I want it out by the end of the day." And District 65 also pulled millions of dollars from manufacturers Hanover. 15 years later, Cleveland Robinson would speak alongside Nelson Mandela at an event in New York City to support the ANC. Prexy recalls that when unions joined the fight, ultimately, that, you know, it was strong. It was very strong solidarity. A third lesson from Prexy and his cohort was to think globally and locally and act globally and locally. Prexy's circle continuously sought to interrelate international and local concerns, both because they wanted to deepen understanding of the globally enmeshed character of racial capitalism, but also to reach people emotionally. I don't know if that's my phone. Their discovery that a new state office building in Chicago was being built with South African steel at a time when the city's large steel plants on the south side had recently closed handed activists a powerful new strategy. The governor was clearly embarrassed by the discovery and claimed falsely at the building's dedication in 1985 that only two beams of South African steel were used. Actually, 30 to 40 beams of steel came from South Africa. But the exact number of beams, of course, is not important, the organizers declared. The use of any South African steel symbolizes the bitter irony of using tax money paid by Illinois residents to support the South African steel industry while massive numbers of area steel workers are unemployed. A fourth lesson from Prexy's organizing is the need for movements to engage in political education. To overcome American ignorance of the world and to learn about their own government's foreign policy, as well as to counter the distortions and misrepresentations of the mainstream media. Prexy knew the importance of educating Americans about what was really happening in Southern America. Political education happened through newsletters, documentaries, pamphlets, radio programs, and symposia. But without question, hosting speakers from the region was the most effective means of impacting an audience. South Africans, Mozambicans, Namibians traveled widely in the United States in these years, giving firsthand accounts of the racism and violence inflicted by the apartheid regime, and at the same time offering inspiring stories of human connection and the struggle for freedom. Prexy estimates roughly 60 Southern Africans stayed at his home during these years. During the fight for congressional sanctions against South Africa, Kansas Republican Nancy Kassenbaum, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Africa, was seen as susceptible to pressure. Prexy and Nomonde Ngubo, a South African trade unionist, crisscrossed Kansas, visiting 40 different venues to mobilize constituent pressure on Kassenbaum. Quote, I drove everywhere, and we stayed on cots and couches, and we ate meals that people gave us. It was barnstorming. It was organizing in its most wonderful moments, Prexy recalls. He stresses how powerful it was for Americans to hear the voices of South Africans directly impacted by apartheid. Ngubo was also a gifted singer, and people flooded places to hear her sing. And that fall, after a 10-day visit to Africa, Kassenbaum abandoned her support for Reagan's so-called constructive engagement and pivoted in favor of sanctions. A fifth point that I want to hold up is that internationalists supported armed struggle against colonial powers, but stressed the principle of avoiding civilian targets. Moreover, they didn't romanticize the violence. Amilcar Cabral, the leader of the struggle against Portuguese colonialism in Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau, amassed a huge following globally as he waged a successful armed struggle in his country. Cabral stressed the importance of culture to social transformation and tailoring socialist development and nation building to the needs of the global South. Cabral was committed to, as he put it, forging a nation by means of the struggle. But at the same time, he did not celebrate the taking up of arms. Quote, maybe I deceive people, he said, but I'm not a great defender of the armed fight. I am, myself, very conscious of the sacrifices demanded of the armed fight. And yet, armed struggle did exhaust the Portuguese regime. Tragically, Cabral did not live to see the fruits of his victory. Local proxies of the Portuguese secret police assassinated him a year before war-weary Portuguese soldiers overthrew the Lisbon dictatorship. The anti-colonial struggle had catalyzed a left-wing military coup and popular uprising in Lisbon that reshaped the balance of forces in Southern Africa, spelling the end of Portuguese rule. For its part, the ANC's armed faction focused on military targets, and Oliver Tambo pledged that they would not kill captured South African combatants. This cast in sharp relief the extraordinary violence of the apartheid regime toward both ordinary people and protesters alike. Well, I don't really have time. A fifth point, which I don't really have time to go into, but I'll just state, was that the anti-apartheid movement was intergenerational, but youthful daring and direct action campus protests dramatically moved the needle in the 1980s in a similar fashion that we see happening on campuses today. Finally, the importance of reframing the narrative is another major lesson of the anti-apartheid struggle that's relevant for the Palestinian struggle. The American right had long used Cold War terminology to defend its alliance with apartheid South Africa, and this held a certain traction in mainstream media. The movement, though, ultimately succeeded in transforming the narrative to emphasize racial harms and moral injuries over anti-communism. This was crucial in winning congressional sanctions. Thank you very much.
Okay, good morning, everyone. And thank you, Morgan, for your introduction. I am going to be taking a slightly different tact. I'm going to be speaking on a research project that I'm working on towards a book on Winnie Madikizela Mandela, but I wanted to just spend maybe 2 minutes talking a bit about Winnie Mandela's particular relationship to Palestinian liberation and within the context of South Africa's relationship. Most of you know that in December of last year, South Africa took apartheid Israel to court, to the International Criminal Court of Justice. And there's a long history of South African solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. So I just want to give a couple examples. The very first visit that Nelson and Winnie Mandela took after Nelson Mandela was released from 27 years of incarceration on February 10th of 1990 was to Lusaka, Zambia, where they met with, among other people, Yasser Arafat, but also Muammar Gaddafi and Fidel Castro. And Nelson Mandela, in particular, was very committed to showing his solidarity and support for Palestine and, in general, for his friends. And there is one example, I don't know, some of you may have heard of it, when Nelson and Winnie traveled to New York in 1990. In June of 1990, there was a town hall meeting that Ted Koppel organized. And at this meeting, and I just want to quote this, because it's really important, particularly as we think about how to respond to the new McCarthyism and this repression around any solidarity with Palestine. One of the people from the audience, and I won't say their name, but challenged and even chastised Nelson Mandela for having met with Yasser Arafat as one of the first, but also Castro. And in response to this, and the man even used words like immoral in response to that, Mandela responded, "One of the mistakes which some political analysts make is to think that their enemies should be our enemies." This received thunderous applause, and by the way, Winnie Mandela and was sitting next to Harry Belafonte in the audience and was clearly very excited by this tact. That we can't and we will not do. We have our own struggle, which we are conducting, and we are grateful to the world for supporting our struggle. But nevertheless, we are an independent organization with its own policies, and our attitude towards every country is determined by the attitude of that country in our struggle. Yasser Arafat, Colonel Gaddafi, Fidel Castro supported our struggle to the hilt. There is no reason whatsoever why we should have any hesitation based solely on the fact that they fully supported our anti-apartheid struggle. And then just one other thing, he talked about South Africa supporting Israel's right to exist and to have safe borders, but emphasized that these borders should be the pre-1967 borders. And so, I mean, just very, very consistent in his pronouncement of support for Palestine. Winnie Mandela was also consistently a supporter of Palestine, and I'm trying to find this quote because she stated that apartheid Israel in 2004 can be defeated just as apartheid in South Africa was defeated, and also was a supporter of BDS. So I just wanted to throw those sort of points out. And as people know, South Africa in general has been one of the sort of strongest advocates or in solidarity for Palestine. So my talk is, as I said, on Winnie Madikizela Mandela. It's an accounting of the life and times, based on a book that I'm working on, which is an accounting of the life and times of the famous and infamous, enigmatic and defiant, courageous, unruly, controversial, and polarizing heroine of the national liberation struggle in South Africa. Winnie was a symbol of assertive black womanhood and a figure of black anger and defiance. She is famously credited for keeping her husband Nelson Mandela's name alive during his 27 years in prison. People called her, like Mary Makeba, was often referred to as the mother, in this case, the mother of the nation, and also Ma'am Winnie. She was a militant freedom fighter, a comrade, and social worker, all hats she would wear in her long struggle for freedom. Winnie declared war on apartheid and its agents, and around this she was resolute. She declared war, and this commitment became even intensified after her 491 days in prison, most of which was spent under solitary confinement. Until the mid-1980s, she was portrayed as a living martyr to the black liberation struggle against the evils of apartheid and white supremacy. During her 8-year banishment in the Orange Free State, in a small town called Branford, where she was sent because she was accused of having been involved with the Soweto Uprising of 1976, she became iconic in the international sort of movement against apartheid, but also imperialism more broadly. And during her time in Branford, she was visited by celebrities, Coretta Scott King, various members of Congress, Ted Kennedy and his family. And it really became in Branford a kind of pilgrimage. But by the mid-1980s, and specifically after she left this internal exile in Branford, she returned to Soweto. Now, she was still under banishment, and there is in 1985, she was actually involved in a car chase with the security police of South Africa for simply trying to go back to Soweto, to her home. And ultimately, she succeeded in simply defying her banishing order and staying in Soweto. But shortly after her return to Soweto, Shortly after her return to Soweto, she began to speak very publicly. During her banishments, she wasn't allowed, or during her banning order, she wasn't allowed to be quoted. She wasn't allowed to be interviewed by the international media. And so this started to change, and her words became very militant. And as a result, this is when she began giving interviews to the media and speaking at funerals and other large gatherings. Described by the Chicago Defender as South Africa's leading black dissident, Winnie began to ramp up the rhetoric, advising that blacks will no longer seek peace talks with South Africa's white minority government unless it is for the handing over of power. She roundly condemned the U.S. policy towards South Africa, stating it appears that U.S. interests in this country outweigh their so-called abhorrence to apartheid. It is during this time that Winnie gave her most notorious speech at Musseville, in which she stated, "And together, hand in hand with our matches and necklaces, we shall liberate this country." The Western media clutched its pearls, and we all remember the reporting during those days with a heavy emphasis on black-on-black violence, obscuring the systematic destruction of black life by the state. Shortly after her return to Soweto, she formed the Mandela United Football Club. They did actually play football initially, but basically they were security guards for her. And they lived at her home and became implicated in violence and intimidation, including rape and murder, and culminating in the kidnapping and murder of a 14-year-old UDF activist, UDF is United Democratic Front, named Stompie Moketsi Sipai, late in 1988. There were many things that were added to what was sort of became known as Winnie's fall from grace, calling her worthiness as a symbolic mother of the nation into question. And you know, I'm not going to go into all of those, but they tended to relate to her sex life, her so-called opulence, building a house in an area called Diepholz, and generally her reputation as being indisciplined and very independent, hard to manage. In response to this, Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo formed the Crisis Committee, who were charged with informing Nelson about Winnie's activities. So fast forward to 1996, the first democratic elections in South Africa were in 1994. In 1996, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission held a special investigation of the Mandela United Football Club. And in that investigation, Archbishop Desmond Tutu begged Winnie to apologize for her part in the violence perpetrated by the Mandela United Football Club. And in response to his pleas, she stated, "I am saying it is true. Things went horribly wrong. I fully agree to that. And or that part of those painful years when things went terribly wrong, and we were aware of the fact that there were factors that led to this. For that, I am deeply sorry." So she was hedging on the apology, but you know, this was as far as she was willing to go. And one of the reasons for this is her general position was that, well, let's just focus on a very common quote. "I'm not sorry, I will never be sorry. I would do everything I did again if I had to, everything." I argue that this popular quote of Winnie's is consistent with her position that she was a product of the hate and violence that the apartheid government and its agents, like Thaniel Swaypoel, the man who interrogated her during her 491 days of incarceration. Winnie was fighting back, sometimes flailing back. Quoting Sisonke Masimang, "Winnie was a fighter, and her legacy is precisely this, to remind us to keep fighting. For this, we owe her and all the unruly women like her an everlasting debt." Auntie Krog had a less generous spin, but a good point just the same, and something that I'm grappling with. She stated, "When a hero or heroine or public figure falls from grace, their supporters and detractors engage in a battle over representation. How would she or he be seen, understood, and framed? After they die, the battle is over legacy. How should they be remembered? Should they be remembered at all? How should they be categorized? How should their life be assessed? The factions exchange barbs as they highlight, paint over, or justify the figure's imperfections, blemishes, and representational notoriety." This was and remains the case with Namzama Winifred Madikizela Mandela, who, following her death on April 2nd of 2018, was treated to a whirlwind of representational violence. In the whirlwind of caustic obituaries, particularly those out of the West, published on the day of her death, she was called everything but a leader, or how does that expression go, everything but a child of God. One had to read an entirely different sort of papers, which tended to come out a bit later, to sort of hear her described as a revolutionary. She was called a dangerous woman, the mugger of the New South Africa. Oh my goodness. Okay. She was called a dangerous woman, the mugger of the New South Africa, a flawed heroine, and the Soweto Mafia. We were lucky if you could hear one sentence of the many things that she had done, the huge role that she had played, and the many sacrifices that she had made on the ground and on the front lines of the country's long struggle for freedom. She was a sinner to Nelson Mandela's saint. For instance, a piece by Ed Cropley in Reuters refers to her uncompromising methods and refusal to forgive, as if people are entitled to be forgiven. Contrast it sharply with the reconciliation espoused by her husband, Nelson Mandela, and he worked to forge a stable pluralistic democracy from the racial division and oppression of apartheid. So, Winnie Mandela was characterized not only by the apartheid government and during the period of apartheid, but also the post-apartheid government as defiant and basically and consistently untamable. Okay, so I am going to basically, who was Winnie? Very briefly, it's very important to look at Winnie as a grassroots leader, and specifically as a leader in the lurch. In other words, she was a leader with no formal support or power on paper, with no clear blueprint about how to proceed. There was no detailed mandate after the ANC and PAC were banned, and the leaders were either in jail or in exile. According to Horst Kleinschmidt, who had supported Winnie during these days and who was the director of the International Defense Force, the ANC leadership focused on getting military training in the Eastern Bloc countries and invested little in the home arena. And as a result, Winnie was not able to keep her jobs. She was trained as a medical social worker. She worked at a hospital called Baragwanath, but she was not able to keep that job after participating in an anti-pass march and lost all of her successive jobs as well. So she basically lived as a poor person and lived in precarity. One of her lawyers, Priscilla Jana, referred to her as the elegantly poor. She took a lot of attention on how she presented herself, and often her clothing was a form of resistance, as she was known to wear ANC colors, wear dukes, and otherwise find ways to sort of embody a kind of defiance. As many of you know, she was incarcerated for 491 days, and it was here that she really became the militant leader that many people began to characterize more for her sort of violence. And what I would do if I had more time is I would talk a bit about some of her political influences, including Frantz Fanon. And when we think about the ways in which Black liberation leaders and, you know, liberations of leaders of color in general are often associated with violence in a way that obscures the systematic violence of the colonial state and the empire. And so Winnie, in many ways, came to epitomize violence in a similar way that Frantz Fanon did, but also in a similar way she saw her hatred and her violence as a product of the hatred and the violence that had been directed at her. And so, sort of in keeping with this idea, she refused to apologize. And I think I'm going to end here, but just wanted to talk about why it's important to tell this story from a Black feminist lens. Winnie's story has been, essentially, there's been a strong effort to cancel her story and her legacy, not only from external sources, but also internal forces, because she was fighting against not only apartheid and white supremacy and imperialism, but also patriarchy and other sort of systems of oppression and power. Towards the later years, she became involved with a group called the Economic Freedom Fighters, never left the ANC, but it was very clear in her political independence. And so I'm going to stop it here, but part of writing Winnie's story is really to look at the way in which she navigated and improvised in her sort of pursuit of freedom. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.